Observer.org, you're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. Each week, our half-hour program features writers from the Texas Observer and other esteemed guests for a conversation about the biggest issues in Texas politics and culture. In the studio this week, we're joined by Observer editor Dave Mann and politics writer Chris Hooks. Guys, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Hey, Jonathan.
Later in the show, we'll hear from Dr. Marcia Griffin. Dr. Griffin works in a Brownsville clinic less than a mile from the border. She's treated thousands of children and mothers at the border and will be sharing a few of their stories with us today, stories she hopes will shed light on situations faced by families crossing the border into Texas. But before we get to that story, let's talk politics. Senator Dan Patrick and Senator Letitia Van de Putte squared off in the first and only Lieutenant Governor debate this week. We also had a second debate between gubernatorial candidate Senator Wendy Davis and Attorney General Greg Abbott. Chris Hooks carefully watched both campaigns this week. So, Chris, we'll start with you. In one of your blog posts, you indicate that you think Wendy Davis outperformed Greg Abbott in the second debate. What about that debate made you feel that way?
Sure. Well, it's coming at a point in the governor's race where there hasn't really been much interaction between the two candidates. Greg Abbott has been playing this really defensively, and Wendy Davis has been trying to get some punches in, but she hasn't had that many chances to do so, really. They've kind of been sitting far across from each other and lobbing volleys at each other, and they don't always land. And the first debate the other week was kind of in that mold. They didn't really have the chance to talk to each other. It wasn't really a debate. They had the space to kind of give their talking points.
But not a discussion. They weren't really, discussing.
They weren't really in a discussion. They only had the chance to ask each other one question. So it was really kind of a wash. I don't think viewers would have gotten much from watching that. But in this debate, the format was a little different. They got the chance to talk to each other a little bit. It had that kind of rehearsed talking point element to it. But they really had the chance to talk to each other for probably the first time in the campaign so far. And I think Wendy Davis benefited from that format. She was a lot more relaxed and looser than she was in the first debate. She got the chance to, take some of the criticism she's been making of Abbott and make him to his face. And it was a format that really benefited her, I think.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about those criticisms. Which ones stand out for you?
Big news story that's come up in the last a week about the Texas Enterprise Fund. So Wendy Davis, in the campaign so far, has been making a lot of criticisms that Greg Abbott is an insider. They've really been trying to play up the corruption angle. Greg Abbott's been in state government for a long time, and there's a lot in his personal history which is not necessarily that complimentary to him. And they've been making this case for many months, and suddenly they have a real news story to tie it to. So the Texas Enterprise Fund is this giant fund that the governor uses to attract economic development to Texas. And there's been a lot of kind of shady things happening in the fund. There hasn't been much oversight, and Greg Abbott's office has kind of been involved in that. So she had the opportunity to talk a bit about that. He was asking tough questions from the panel of moderators, which he wasn't really able to answer. It was probably his weakest moment in the debate.
Yeah, it seemed like Greg Abbott, at least from my vantage point, it seemed like Greg Abbott didn't have a great response to that, and that I guess part of his response was what did Wendy Davis do about it? And that doesn't seem to be such a great answer because Wendy Davis is in the Senate. And of course, when this was going on, I don't even think she was in state government. I mean, a lot of the revelations about the Enterprise Fund were from the really early days of the Enterprise Fund, the first couple of years back in 03, 04, 05, stuff like that. So when Greg Abbott was Attorney General and Wendy Davis was not in state government, so it seemed like that was kind of a weak rejoinder, right?
Yeah, he had kind of a complicated line that he tried to bring up about when city incentives and programs that Wendy Davis might have been involved in before she was in state government. But it wasn't, especially because Wendy Davis was in the Senate, was the one that called for this audit that produced these findings about the Texas Enterprise Fund. It didn't seem like it was necessarily the best line for him to use. Of course, the problem with these debates is that not many people watch them. Even if she had a really great showing, it's probably not going to have that big of an effect on the race, you would think.
Do you think she would have connected with voters or people who were tuning into this, if they did tune into it? As you say, maybe a lot of people didn't, but say somebody did, and they weren't very familiar with Wendy Davis, or they hadn't really seen her before, or Greg Abbott for that matter, do you think either one of them would have really connected with voters?
Well, there's the kind of superficial level as to how they appeared, which is important in these debates like that. And yeah, Wendy Davis was a lot more kind of relaxed and comfortable, and I guess you could say seemed more relatable. Greg Abbott didn't have a bad night, but he, at points he seemed a little aloof, a little awkward. But it was also the great thing about the debate was that there was kind of, at points, there was something approximating like a substantive policy discussion. So you had Wendy Davis making a really strong case for Medicaid expansion and other policies that we people in Texas might not have necessarily heard those cases before. And it's a campaign that has really seen a dearth of those kind of discussions. So if someone was tuning in didn't know much about either candidate, I would think that they would come away with a more favorable view of Davis than that. But
yeah, and the Medicaid expansion discussion was interesting. I before this, you know, I couldn't have told you what Greg Abbott's position on Medicaid expansion was. I would have guessed maybe he'd probably be against it, but you know, that would just be a guess. I didn't really know where he was coming from in that, and he was proposing that, you know, Medicaid basically be a block grant. And that was kind of his idea, which is an idea we've heard many, many times from Texas Republicans, and is certainly not happening in the Obama administration. So that doesn't seem particularly realistic. So from a Medicaid expansion discussion, that just seemed like a pipe dream. So I thought it was a really interesting discussion for them to have. So at least clarify where they stood on maybe one of the most important issues in Texas politics right now, in my view. And at least clarify where Greg Abbott stands. And in my view, it's kind of, it's just not a realistic position to take, you know, for, you know, Medicaid block grants. But, you know, at least they had the discussion and the positions are clarified.
Yeah, and that's something the Bush administration wouldn't give the state of Texas either, block granting Medicaid. I mean, it's something that most people don't really think has a realistic chance of being an actual policy solution. But Wendy Davis has kind of found a way to take this really important topic. Medicaid, you know, expansion has the ability to change a lot of people's lives in the state for the positive. I mean, it's a really important thing. She's found a way to turn it into a practical matter or a pragmatic argument. And
she, economic argument.
She made this really forceful argument that, you know, tax dollars from Texas were going to the IRS and going to subsidize medical care in other states and it could be coming back here.
Let's get that money back to work for Texans.
Yeah.
Of course, Medicaid expansion was also a big topic of discussion for the lieutenant governor debate. What did you think about that debate? Well, and I think we should mention it's the only one, right? That was it. So if you missed it, you're out of luck.
Yeah, it's there's not a lot of back and forth discussion in this in Texas campaigns these days. I mean, we have to be grateful for whatever space opens up to allow these people to talk to each other. The most interesting thing to me was the Dan Patrick that showed up to the debate. In the primary, he was this really fiery guy. He was maybe the most far-right candidate that Texas has seen in modern times that's had this level of electoral success. And then when he won the primary, he kind of receded a little bit. And it seemed like maybe he was trying to find a more moderate profile to run with, that he knew that he was probably going to be lieutenant governor and he was going to try to alter his positions a little bit to make them more realistic. But the guy who showed up at the lieutenant governor's debate was much closer to the guy that ran in the primary than the guy who he's been lately. There might be some people that would have liked to think that Dan Patrick was changing his shape, and it doesn't really seem like he's doing that.
Yeah, he seems to be taking the Ted Cruz approach, which is, you know, be this fiery guy in the primary, and then when people expect you to, you know, moderate back toward the middle, don't do that, right? Stay true to this really kind of farther right ideological course. Stay true to the Tea Party and just go with it and see what happens. And Ted Cruz has been incredibly successful. I mean, I think some people would have expected him to, once he got in the Senate, kind of moderate a little bit. And he hasn't. And he's just been out there and forceful. And Dan Patrick's performance kind of reminded me of that. Like, okay, here are these pretty radical proposals that I've made. I'm going to stick to my guns and I'm going to throw them out there in this debate.
So is that what
and
is...
see what happens. And then, and sorry, I'm just, but, and it's interesting because the big difference is that Ted Cruz in the U.S. Senate really has no power, right? I mean, he's got the power of publicity. He's got the power of the bully pulpit a little bit, but practically speaking, he can't really influence much. But the lieutenant governor of Texas is an incredibly powerful position. And Dan Patrick as lieutenant governor would have real power and have real authority. And so, yes, he's taking the Ted Cruz tack, which is kind of interesting, but it's also, for people who don't agree with him, probably kind of alarming, because here's a guy who's going to walk into one of the most powerful positions in the state with what can best be described as fairly, you know, radical policy positions. That something unique probably in Texas politics, at least in the last 2 or 3 decades, I would say. If somebody this far out getting that kind of power, so I agree. I thought he was right-wing Dan Patrick in that debate. And it's probably pretty alarming for a lot of people, the prospect of him getting in office.
But did either of you feel like there were any moments where he sort of reached out to a more general audience, or was he targeting the Tea Party with his performance for the majority of it?
It was interesting because I thought he's very well-spoken. I mean, he's a radio talk show host, and so he's really good in the media. He's just very natural on stage. Of all the candidates, he's the most natural on screen. He sounds like he's just talking to you. So it sounds great and looks good, but if you actually listen to what he's saying, it's fairly radical stuff. So he's describing fairly radical policy positions in a very reasonable tone and kind of a reasonable way. So I got the sense he was trying to justify radical policy positions by explaining them. And sometimes that was successful and sometimes that wasn't. But it was interesting, the contrast of seeming very conversational, very reasonable, but the actual content of what he was saying is outside the mainstream.
Yeah, it's interesting. He has a really great ability to conceal radical positions with that kind of language. I mean, he said he was like the best friend public education had, which was news to everybody watching the debate. and he did have his message. You know, he wants to radically overhaul the way Texas' tax system works. And but he kind of, the way he talks about that is by saying that he wants to lower people's property taxes, which is a for someone who's not maybe tuned into how state government works, is a really appealing message. But I also came away with that, you know, there are the kind of these three big policy areas in which Dan Patrick really wants to leave his mark. And when he was in the Senate last time, that was public education. He was the chair of public education. And he wants to introduce vouchers and kind of do all of these things that change the way public education works, which is this huge legislative program. And then during the primary, he had all of these things he wanted to do about the border. And it's these kind of extreme positions kind of moving us more in the direction of a state like Arizona. And that's another huge legislative program. And then at the debate, what he's highlighting is this tax program. He wants to raise sales taxes and decrease local sales taxes. So basically moving Texas from a state in which the primary model of taxes affect people in the middle class more to a system which affects people on the lower end of the economic spectrum more. And it's this really kind of radical overhaul of the way state government works. And if he does make it past Letitia Van de Put and takes over the Senate in January, he's going to need to... you know, make big strides on these three packages, and it's the next session is really going to be something to watch, I think.
Well, real quickly, let's talk about Letitia Van de Put's performance earlier this week. What can you tell us about that?
She was warm and engaging. At points a little bit corny. That's kind of how she is, I think. She cut a more appealing figure, I think, for a lot of people than Dan Patrick would be.
But I don't know if I totally agree with that.
Okay.
I thought she sounded scripted, to be honest. It was almost the opposite of Dan Patrick. It was a really interesting contrast because the way she was saying things to me sounded very scripted and stilted. It sounded like she had memorized answers on topics she thought would be asked about, and she was kind of going through them. And was trying to be, you know, smile and be warm and engaging, but it what she was saying was sounded scripted. Even though the words, the content of what she was saying pretty much represents the middle ground of Texas politics, I think, right now. It all sounded, you know, pretty mainstream, or at least, you know, center left mainstream for a Democratic candidate. But the way she was saying it, I thought didn't come off well. Or contrast that with Dan Patrick, who I thought sounded very natural and very reasonable. And here's what I think, and here's what I've done, and here's why I did it, and here's why I think this. That was, to me, that was more relatable, even though the actual content of what he was saying was probably outside the mainstream. That was my impression of the debate. It's interesting to me that here's Letitia Van de Put, who is very experienced in state politics, talks all the time. I didn't get the sense she could talk on her feet as well as Dan Patrick could. And maybe that's an unreasonable expectation, but to me, she sounded a little too scripted in that debate, which, you know, you don't want to get too caught up on appearances and things like that. But I do think that it impacts how people hear what she's saying, how people relate to her, you know, if they watch the debate.
No, I'll actually go along with that. I Van de Put does a lot better in front of a small room of people, and she can be really good making speeches. But I do think you're probably right about that.
And I've gotten the same impression from Wendy Davis. I mean, it's on numerous occasions where she seemed stilted and a little scripted. Greg Abbott too. I mean, they both kind of sound like lawyers who are running for office, which is of course what they are. But they both seem like candidates who are being really heavily stage managed, being really heavily scripted. There isn't spontaneity, and that's great. I mean, that's how politics is right now. But the losers are us in the press and the voters, you know, who don't really get a feel for who these candidates are and don't really get a natural debate. So, I obviously that favors that kind of scriptedness favors the party in power, which is the Republicans. So to me, I think the Democrats probably would benefit from a little bit more spontaneity, a little bit more charisma, a little bit more personality. And so far, I haven't seen that from either Van de Put or Wendy Davis.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. Working at a clinic in Brownsville, Dr. Marcia Griffin sees firsthand the grim reality faced by Central Americans crossing the Texas-Mexico border. In Doctors with Borders, Griffin writes that she, quote, can no longer remain silent while the predominant U.S. news sources spew hateful lies about the children and families she knows intimately. The stories she shares are ones of fear and worry, but also stories of passion and struggle and also love. Dr. Griffin, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you for that beautiful introduction and recognizing that it's full of love.
Well, I can't take all the credit for that. Our associate editor, Forrest Wilder, helped pen that. So
he's
unfortunately not here. But yeah, he is great. So if you don't mind, would you mind telling us what made you want to share your story and the stories of the families you've met?
When the surge of Central Americans were going on, or that this was going on during June and July and August, the national media was just so, in many instances, was so hateful. There was just a few that you could pick out that was giving a more balanced view of what was going on. And it was just so hateful, and it was giving a bad view of our region and of our community as well, as a very scary place, as a very fearful place to go, and it actually is not. It's a very safe place, and these people and the children are very beautiful, and their stories are tragic.
We've talked about this issue from several different angles on the show. One of the ones we chose to talk about, we had Rachel Pearson on. She wrote a story for The Observer about how kids crossing the border are actually not bringing any diseases. In some cases, they are very well vaccinated. Is that the sort of thing that you're talking about?
No, I think that's one of the messages. But it's also that why they're coming, and they want to boil it down to a very simple reason. They're coming to take benefits from U.S. citizens. They want to abuse the system. They're coming only for economic reasons, or that their parents must be something less than real parents that they would let them go. And the stories are much more complicated than that. And it's not simple, and it cannot be done. It can't be encapsulated like that.
So there are a great many stories that you write about in your piece, and I'll let people find those on their own. You can read them on TexasObserver.org. But I was wondering if there are any stories that didn't make it into your piece that you'd like to share with us now.
There are, Jonathan, mountains of stories, because I've been down here for 8 years and have just seen and asked people questions of why they were here and welcoming them to our community. And when you ask them and ask them how their families are and where they came from and why they came, the stories have just been mounting up. I think there would not be a single one, because there's so many. I think the gist of those stories is that families are torn apart, and that in order to have their children safe, they had to separate their family and send their children on a very dangerous journey, and not one that they would have chosen. They would have chosen something very different. And so when they get here, there are stories of children not being able to go home and see their parents, parents not able to come up here and see their children, being raised by a guardian or an aunt, and not knowing when they're going to see them again. And so those bring tragedy just in the separation, and that a mother can no longer control who's their child's environment. And so that's the most, you know, telling. There was one, so I will tell one, there was one mother who came in, and she came in, like 10 days after her baby was born, she came in. I did the exam and welcomed her to the clinic and asked her where she had lived before. And usually the moms bring their babies in at day 2 or day 3 of life, and this had been longer. The woman had her own mother with her. And so when I asked this question of why the delay, was there any problem, the mother started crying, and the grandmother filled in that the father of the child had been murdered by the drug cartel in Mexico, and that on the day that the child was born, and that, or I'm sorry, 3 days after he was born, and that the mother, in her grief, quit nursing. And so she didn't nurse him for 4 or 5 days. They were able to get on this side and be safe. And the mother came in wanting to know if she had lost her chance to have that connection with her only boy, and that she wanted help with being able to nurse her son again. And so those were the kind of stories that we're hearing, whether it's from Central America or from Mexico. The level of violence is more than we can even imagine here in the United States.
Dr. Griffin, this is Dave. I wanted to thank you for writing the piece. I found it very moving, and I think anybody who reads it, especially as a parent, you know, you can't help but be affected by that, because these are stories, a lot of the stories you tell are stories of children and parents being separated from children. I'm curious what you think can be done here, because obviously a lot of the reason, a lot of the big factors here are poverty and violence, and kind of big issues that are hard to address, especially internationally. But I'm wondering, you know, from your perspective on the border, is there anything that we can do in this country that would ease the plight, you know, especially these children kind of coming here for sanctuary in a lot of ways? You know, what if we could kind of get past some of the heated rhetoric on both sides of this issue? What, practically speaking, could we do to kind of address this situation?
Well, that's a very good question. There are communities in the country that are coming together to try to address just that. And our community did that very thing this Valentine's Day. We had a gathering of 55 leaders from 17 institutions to address this kind of fear and how do we, the fear among the community because of the militarization on the border. So these are two different issues. There's one along the border, which is a very peaceful region with people who value families and hospitality, and now we're overrun with Border Patrol and ICE agents and now National Guard and militia. And that presence has caused fear in our community. So our community actually is not afraid of the immigrants. They're afraid of these militarized people in uniforms or quasi-uniforms. So there's one issue here of we don't need more boots on the ground and down here. The other issue that other communities across the country have been doing is bringing kind of the same groups of people, people from the religious communities, people from the schools, attorneys, people from social organizations or community-based organizations to say, what can we do to prepare for these children? Because the Central American children aren't staying down on the border of Texas and Mexico. They're predominantly going north and all over the United States and a lot to the East Coast, California, Nebraska, Kansas, Louisiana, North Carolina. They're all over. And some of these very thoughtful, compassionate communities are coming together to say, what do we need to do? What services do we need to identify, especially mental health services? Because most of these children have been traumatized in their home country or on the trip. And they've seen violence, which can include some pretty horrific tales back in their home country or have themselves been beaten or tortured or watched their family members beaten or tortured or raped. And so they're leaving and going to other parts of the country, and the schools and the churches and the temples and synagogues, they and the mosques need to know these children are there and start rallying troops to be able to identify them and support them and give them that kind of support.
The story is Doctors with Borders. You can read it on TexasObserver.org. Dr. Marcia Griffin, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Jonathan, and all the rest of you at Texas Observer. We love you.
That's it for Observer Radio this week. But before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music. And of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Scholes. For more Texas news and culture, you can visit us on the web at TexasObserver.org or pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk to you again next time on Observer Radio.